Manfred de la Rey still had a boxer's physique, wide shoulders and powerful neck. But he was thickening around the waist, and his jawline was beginning to blur with flesh. He wasn't keeping himself in shape, and hard muscle was turning flabby. Chaucer glanced down at his own lean hips and greyhound belly with self-satisfaction, and then concentrated again on his adversary. Manfred de la Rey's nose was twisted, and there was a gleaming white scar through one of his dark eyebrows, injuries he had received in the boxing ring. However, his eyes were a strange pale colour, like yellow topaz, implacable as the eyes of a cat, and yet with the fire of his fine intellect in their depths. Like all the Nationalist cabinet ministers, with the exception of the Prime Minister himself, he was a highly educated and brilliant man, devout and dedicated, totally convinced of the divine right of his party and his folk. They truly believe they are God's instruments on earth. That's what makes them so damn dangerous. Chaucer smiled grimly as Manfred finished speaking and sat down to the roar of approval from his own side of the house. They were waving order papers, and the Prime Minister leaned across to pat Manfred's shoulder, while a dozen congratulatory notes were passed to him from the back benches. Chaucer used this distraction to murmur an excuse to his father-in-law. Now, you won't need me for the rest of the day, but if you do, you'll know where to find me. Then he stood up, bowed to the speaker, and as unobtrusively as possible headed for the exit. However, Chaucer was 6'1" tall, and with the black patch over one eye and his dark waving hair and good looks, he drew more than a few speculative glances from the younger women in the visitors' gallery, and a hostile appraisal from the government benches. Manfred de la Rey glanced up from the note he was reading as Chaucer passed, and the look they exchanged was intent but enigmatic. Then Chaucer was out of the chamber, and he shrugged off his jacket and slung it over his shoulder as he acknowledged the salute of the doorman and went out into the sunshine. Chaucer did not keep an office in the Parliament building, for the seven-storied Saint-Anne House, the headquarters of the Courtney Mining and Finance Company Limited, was just 2 minutes' walk across the gardens. As he strode along under the oaks, he mentally changed hats, doffing his political topper for the businessman's Homburg. Chaucer kept his life in separate compartments, and he had trained himself to concentrate on each in its turn, without ever allowing his energy to dissipate by spreading it too thinly. By the time he crossed the road in front of St. George's Cathedral and went into the revolving glass front door of Saint-Anne House, he was thinking of finance and mining, juggling figures and choices, weighing factual reports against his own instincts, and enjoying the game of money as hugely as he had the rituals and confrontations on the floor of the Houses of Parliament. The two pretty girls at the reception desk in the entrance lobby, with its marbled floors and columns, burst into radiant smiles. "Good afternoon, Mr. Courtney," they chorused. And he devastated them with his smile as he crossed to the lifts. His reaction to them was instinctive. He liked pretty females around him, although he would never touch one of his own people. Somehow that would have been incestuous and unsporting, for they would not be able to refuse him, too much like shooting a sitting bird. Still, the two young females at the desk sighed and rolled their eyes as the lift doors closed on him. Janet, his secretary, had heard the lift and was waiting as the doors opened. She was more Chaucer's type, mature and poised, groomed and efficient, and though she made little attempt to conceal her adoration, Chaucer's self-imposed rules prevailed here also. "What have we got, Janet?" he demanded. And as she followed him across the antechamber to his own office, she read off his appointments for the rest of the afternoon. He went first to the ticker tape in the corner and ran the closing prices through his fingers. Anglo's had dropped 2 shillings. It was almost time to buy again. "Ring Allen and put him off. I'm not ready for him yet," he told Janet, and went to his desk. "Give me 15 minutes and then get David Abrams on the phone." As she left the room, Chaucer settled to the pile of telex sheets and urgent messages that she had left on his blotter. He worked swiftly through them, undistracted by the magnificent view of Table Mountain through the window on the opposite wall. And when one of the phones rang, he was ready for David. "Hello, Davy. What's happening in Joburg?" It was a rhetorical question. He knew what was happening, and what he was going to do about it. The daily reports and estimates were amongst the pile on his desk, but he listened carefully to David's resume. David was group managing director. He had been with Schasser since varsity days, and he was as close to Schasser as no other person, with the exception of Saint-Anne. Although the Hanee diamond mine near Windhoek in the north was still the fountainhead of the company's prosperity and had been for the 32 years since Saint-Anne Courtney had discovered it, under Schasser's direction the company had expanded and diversified until he had been forced to move the executive headquarters from Windhoek to Johannesburg. Johannesburg was the commercial centre of the country, and the move was inevitable. But Johannesburg was also a bleak, heartless and unattractive city. Saint-Anne Courtney Malcolmes refused to leave the beautiful Cape of Good Hope to live there, so the company's financial and administrative headquarters remained in Cape Town. It was a clumsy and costly duplication, but Saint-Anne always got her way. Moreover, it was convenient for Schasser to be so close to Parliament, and as he loved the Cape as much as she did, he did not try to change her mind. Schasser and David spoke for 10 minutes before Schasser said, "Right, we can't decide on this on the phone. I'll come up to you." "When?" "Tomorrow afternoon. Sean has a rugby match at 10 in the morning. I can't miss it. I promised him." David was silent a moment as he considered the relative importance of a schoolboy's sporting achievement against the possible investment of something over £10 million in the development of the company's options on the new Orange Free State goldfields. "Give me a ring before you take off," David agreed with resignation. "I'll meet you at the airfield myself." Schasser hung up and checked his wristwatch. He wanted to get back to Weltevrieden in time to spend an hour with the children before their bath and dinner. He could finish his work after his own dinner. He began to pack the remaining papers on his desk into his black crocodile skin Hermes briefcase, when Janet tapped on the interleading door and came into his office. "I'm sorry, sir. This has just been delivered by hand. A parliamentary messenger, and he said it was very urgent." Schasser took the heavy quality envelope from her. It was the type of expensive stationery reserved for use by members of the cabinet, and the flap was embossed with the coat of arms of the Union, the quartered shield and rampant antelopes supporting it with the motto in the ribbon beneath, "Ex Unitate Vires." Strength through unity. "Thank you, Janet." He broke the flap with his thumb and took out a single sheet of notepaper. It was headed, "Office of the Minister of Police," and the message was handwritten in Afrikaans. "Dear Mr. Courtney, knowing of your interest in hunting, an important personage has asked me to invite you to a springbok hunt on his ranch over the coming weekend. There is an airstrip on the property, and the coordinates are as follows. 28 degrees 32 minutes south, 26 degrees 16 minutes east. I can assure you of good sport and interesting company. Please let me know if you are able to attend. Sincerely, Manfred de la Rey." Schasser grinned and whistled softly through his teeth as he went to the large-scale map on the wall and checked the coordinates. The note amounted to a summons, and he could guess at the identity of the important personage. He saw that the ranch was in the Orange Free State, just south of the goldfields at Welkom, and it would mean only a minor detour off his return course from Johannesburg to reach it. "I wonder what they're up to now," he mused, and he felt a prickle of anticipation. It was the kind of mystery he thoroughly enjoyed, and he scribbled a reply on a sheet of his personal notepaper. "Thank you for your kind invitation to hunt with you this weekend. Please convey my acceptance to our host, and I look forward to the hunting." As he sealed the envelope, he muttered, "In fact, you'd have to nail both my feet to the ground to keep me away." In his green Jaguar SS sports car, Schasser drove through the massive white-painted gateway of Weltevrieden. The pediment had been designed and executed in 1790 by Anton Arnreith, the Dutch East India Company's architect and sculptor, and such an exquisite work of art was a fitting entrance to the estate. since Saint-Anne had handed the estate over to him and gone to live with Blaine Malcolmes on the far side of the Constantiaberg Mountains, Chaucer had lavished the same love and care upon Weltevreden as she had before. The name translated from the Dutch as well-satisfied, and that was how Chaucer felt as he slowed the Jaguar to a walking pace, so as not to blow dust over the vineyards that flanked the road. The harvest was in full swing, and the headscarves of the women working down the rows of shoulder-high vines were bright spots of colour that vied with the leaves of red and gold. They straightened up to smile and wave as Chaucer passed, and the men, doubled under the overflowing baskets of red grapes, grinned at him also. Young Sean was on one of the wagons in the centre of the field, walking the draft horses slowly, keeping pace with the harvest. The wagon was piled high with ripe grapes that glowed like rubies where the powdery bloom had been rubbed from their skin. When he saw his father, Sean tossed the reins to the driver, who had been tactfully supervising him, and leapt over the side of the wagon and raced down the rows of vines to intercept the green Jaguar. He was only 11 years old, but big for his age. He had inherited his mother's clear, shining skin and Chaucer's looks, and although his limbs were sturdy, he ran like an antelope, springy and quick on his feet. Watching him, Chaucer felt that his heart might burst with pride. Sean flung open the passenger door of the Jag and tumbled into the seat, where he abruptly recovered his dignity. "Good evening, Papa," he said, and Chaucer put an arm around his shoulders and hugged him. "Hello, sport. How did it go today?" They drove down past the winery and the stables, and Chaucer parked in the converted barn where he kept his collection of a dozen vintage cars. The Jaguar had been a gift from Saint-Anne, and he favoured it even over the 1928 Phantom I Rolls-Royce, with Hooper coachwork, beside which he parked it. The other children had witnessed his arrival from the nursery windows and came pelting down across the lawns to meet him. Michael, the youngest boy, was leading, with Garrick, his middle son, a good 5 lengths back. Less than a year separated each of the boys. Michael was the dreamer of the family, a fey child who at 9 years of age could lose himself for hours in Treasure Island or spend an afternoon with his box of watercolours, lost to all else in the world. Chaucer embraced him as affectionately as he had his eldest, and then Garrick came up, wheezing with asthma, pale-faced and skinny, with wispy hair that stuck up in spikes. "Good afternoon, Papa," he stuttered. He really was an ugly little brat, Chaucer thought. And where the hell did he get them from, the asthma and the stutter? "Hello, Garrick," Chaucer never called him son, or my boy, or sport, as he did the other two. It was always simply Garrick. And he patted the top of his head lightly. It never occurred to him to embrace the child. The little beggar still peed his bed, and he was 10 years old. Chaucer turned with relief to meet his daughter. "Come on, my angel, come to your daddy." And she flew into his arms and shrieked with rapture as he swung her high, then wrapped both arms round his neck and showered warm, wet kisses on his face. "What does my angel want to do now?" Chaucer asked, without lowering her to the earth. "I want to ride," Isabella declared, and she was already wearing her new jodhpurs. "Then ride we shall," Chaucer agreed. Whenever Tara accused him of encouraging her lisp, he protested, "She's only a baby." "She's a calculating little vixen who knows exactly how to twist you around her little finger, and you let her do it." Now he swung her up onto his shoulders, and she sat astride his neck and took a handful of his hair to steady herself while she bounced up and down, chanting, "I love my daddy." "Come on, everybody," Chaucer ordered. "We're going for a wide before dinner." Sean was too big and grown up to hold hands, but he kept jealously close to Chaucer's right side. Michael was on his left, clinging unashamedly to Chaucer's hand, while Garrick trailed 5 paces behind, looking up adoringly at his father. "I came first in arithmetic today, Daddy," Garrick said softly. But in all the shouting and laughter, Chaucer didn't hear him. The grooms had the horses saddled up already, for the evening ride was a family ritual. In the saddle room, Chaucer slipped off his city shoes and changed them for old, well-polished riding boots, before he lifted Isabella onto the back of her plump little piebald Shetland. Then he went up into the saddle of his own stallion and took Isabella's lead rein from the groom. Company! Forward! Walk! March! Trot! He gave the cavalry command and pumped his hand over his head, a gesture which always reduced Isabella to squeals of delight, and they clattered out of the stable yard. They made the familiar circuit of the estate, stopping to talk with any of the coloured boss boys they met, and exchanging shouted greetings with the gangs of labourers trudging home from the vineyards. Sean discussed the harvest with his father in adult terms, sitting straight and important in the saddle, until Isabella, feeling left out, intervened, and immediately Chasseur leaned over to listen deferentially to what she had to tell him.